Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Heard around the state on Utah Public Radio, I'm Roger McDonough. Today, lawmakers lay out some of the substantial changes coming for Utah's medical cannabis program. Representative Ken Ivory resigns his post at the legislature to take a job with a company he helped secure state funding for. And Senator Mitt Romney says new gun laws should be enacted by states because of gridlock over the issue in Congress. Joining me for this conversation, we've got Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Kahneman. Good morning, Matt. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Also, reporter Bethany Rogers is with us, and good morning to you, Bethany. Thanks for being here. And columnist, news columnist, that is Robert Gerke. Good morning to you, and welcome.
Good morning, Roger.
As always, if you would like to join this discussion with your questions and comments, you can call us. We are at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. You can also post your questions and comments on Twitter. You can tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. And let's begin this morning with comments by a couple of Utah leaders on guns. Senator Mitt Romney, who is visiting his Utah home this week, and Utah Governor Gary Herbert, both made comments about gun laws and actions on mass shootings in the United States. And this is still kind of fallout from the back-to-back mass shootings that took place earlier this month. And Matt Kahneman, senior managing editor with the Tribune, let's start with the governor's comments, if that's all right, which were made at his monthly televised news conference. What did he have to say there?
The governor believes that that all items should be on the table, that something should happen in the legislature on this area. And that's pretty much where he ended it. The governor has said this for a while now, that he's open to debating new laws intended to stop gun violence, particularly mass shootings. The ones that were brought up is some effort to expand background checks beyond where they currently are, or what we call red flag laws. We've written about this quite a bit. I know that both Bethany and Robert have probably written about this for the Tribune during legislative action. These red flag laws would be where someone could alert a judge that a person may hurt himself or herself or someone else. And in that case, a judge could order those guns to be confiscated for a period of time. These laws are becoming popular around the country in places like Florida after the mass shootings there. And it's something that's being talked about on the federal level as well. It seems to be a possibility. The governor also, though, talked about violence in media. It's something that we've heard a lot from Republicans after these mass shootings, though there is not as much evidence that that actually is behind some of these cases.
And that's essentially what the President Trump, also pointed to was, you know, mental health problems.
Right.
Well, violence in media, violence in video games, I guess.
Violence in video games. The governor brought it a little broader just to violence in media in general. Said that Hollywood, you know, what role do we play when we desensitize these actions? He didn't, but I will specify that in this news conference, the governor did not suggest any sort of policy action on any front.
Okay. And then how about comments from Senator Mitt Romney? Did he echo these statements and you know, about violence in media and red flag laws? And actually, where did he make those comments? What was the venue?
Yeah. So Mitt Romney's an interesting case. Obviously, he has a long history on these issues and was more involved in gun bills when he was the governor of Massachusetts, including some restrictions there. After these mass shootings in Ohio and in Texas, he released a statement that went farther than most Republicans, where he said that that some action needed to be taken. This will require courage and a willingness from all sides to find areas of consensus, that he said he wanted to be a constructive voice in that endeavor. But just like the governor, that statement did not say what Senator Romney is in favor of. So the senator visited the Salt Lake Tribune's editorial board this week, and reporter Tony Semerad sat in on that conversation and asked, what do you want to see happen? What Senator Romney said is he's interested in looking at Senator Pat Toomey's bill on background checks. That's a Republican senator from Pennsylvania who wants to expand background checks to all commercial sales. That would include online sales or gun shows. People who are want stronger gun control measures are not satisfied by that bill because it doesn't have any interaction with any sort of private sale. So which would be a big loophole in the sense that I could buy it from a gun show, turn around and sell it to Bethany, and there doesn't have to be any sort of
background
check there. And so they say that's a big loophole, but it would be a significant step forward from our background check system now. The senator said he's in support of that. But then he also said that – this is a quote from the senator. He said, the reality is getting something through Washington will be almost impossible, if not impossible, because the nation is so divided on this issue. Essentially, he punted it back to the states.
Where certain actions could be taken, I mean, including these red flag laws, as you pointed out. Robert Gerke, Salt Lake Tribune news columnist, you know, the idea that certain – I mean, some background checks are a federal issue. Other aspects of this could be done state by state, couldn't they?
Yeah. I mean, there's been several proposals that various states have looked at and many have enacted, you know, including the red flag laws that we've talked about on this show previously. There have been talks about closing the gun show loophole on a state by state basis. You know, it can be done at the state level. I think Senator Romney is wrong in that he says that the nation is divided on this issue. The nation's really not divided on this issue. Washington is divided on this issue. But there, poll after poll has shown 85-90% of the public supports things like red flags laws, things like prohibiting mentally ill people from having weapons, things like these background checks, universal background checks. And there's a majority that support a ban on assault weapons. And so the public is pretty clear in where they want to see this go. It's that as Senator Romney referenced, it's going to take courage to find consensus. Washington's incapable of doing that. And every time we have another mass shooting, every time we have another massacre like we have had recently, and we've had many over the last several years, Washington throws their hands up and they do end up doing nothing. And I think that's what we're going to see again. We're already seeing sort of that stagnation. We're seeing the president, you know, backpedal on things like, you know, on background checks. So, you know, it's the same pattern that we've seen over and over. And I don't think we should expect anything else from, you know, we shouldn't expect our leaders to show courage or willingness to find consensus.
In terms of, again, that's news columnist Robert Gerke with Salt Lake Tribune. In terms of the state legislature's willingness to take up something like a red flag law, is that in the works, Matt Canham?
The bill will come up. Whether the legislature will want to hear it and move it forward, I think, is a heavier lift. This will be the third year of the red flag laws, though?
Yeah, I mean, the first year it came up, Representative Handy brought it up late in the session because, if you remember, we had the Parkland shooting that happened midway through the session, and it took him a while to get a bill drafted, although it was more or less a copy of what other states had already done.
That's 2013?
Or
14, maybe? 13.
That would have been 2017, right?
I think so.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. So 2017 was the first time it came up. It got a hearing. It didn't really get a vote because they just decided they didn't want to rush it. It was recommended as one of the proposals from the School Safety Commission that was looking at steps the state should take to, you know, strengthen the safety of our children at schools. 2018, it came up, got... basically what if to death, you know, there was all these questions about due process. And so actually that was this year, it got what if to death. So that was 2019. So 2018 was the first year, 2019, it came up and was defeated. He's saying he's going to bring it up again this session, this next session in 2020.
Hmm. I was confusing, obviously, Parkland with yet another mass shooting in American history, which was the Connecticut
Sandy Hook.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah, you know, I'm just going to quickly mention also here that just this morning I had a conversation with Senator Mitt Romney about guns, climate change, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade deal, and a great deal more, and that will be available at kcpw.org just a little bit later today. Matt Canham, Senior Managing Editor with the Salt Lake Tribune, is there anything missing from the story, any additional piece of this that as we consider the future of gun policy both in Utah and around the country, we ought to be considering?
Well, I mean, I think what we're going to see is – as Robert alluded to, if there is stagnation in Washington or a sense that something should happen after these last shootings, you know, there does appear to be a small growth in momentum towards doing something. That was what people chanted at rallies, was just do something. What both the senator and the governor are saying is we should do something. Will something actually happen? I remain skeptical just because of the track record we've seen after these mass shootings, but that is different than what's happened in the past.
I'm skeptical that anything significant is going to happen too, but I do think that the legislature deserves some credit for the steps it's taken on trying to prevent suicide by firearms. And you know, there are things like gun locks and gun safes that they've been subsidizing.
Which is the way that most gun deaths in the United States
happen. The preponderance of deaths, especially in Utah, the gun-related deaths are by suicide. And so, so you know, those are positive steps. But there is more that can be done on these again, these red flag laws seem like an easy one. They've been shown to work, not necessarily to prevent mass shootings per se, because those are really hard to predict and prevent, but they also help in preventing suicides. And so states that have enacted those have seen them, you know, can demonstrate how they work. And you know, it's time that we get it done.
Okay. I'm going to remind listeners that you can join this conversation by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Tell us your thoughts on the stories we are covering today. I want to turn now to a different story altogether, and this is one that Bethany Rogers, Salt Lake Tribune reporter, has covered this past week. And Bethany, there have been some issues in the rollout of Utah's medical cannabis program. We've talked about those issues before. District attorneys warning counties that they could be breaking federal law if they acted as a depository or medical marijuana pharmacy. That was one of the more recent hiccups. You reported this week that some pretty sizable changes in this program are on the way. What kind of changes are we talking about?
Yeah, so it seems they're sort of nearing an agreement on what the major changes will be to the state's medical cannabis law in a potential special session. Over interim day, which is the day that legislators gather for committee meetings, and that happened this last week on Wednesday, they received a briefing about the work group and its progress on medical cannabis changes. And it looks like what they're considering is completely doing away with this state-run distribution system. Under the original bill, the state would have had a centralized pharmacy and then prepared cannabis orders for patients to pick them up at local health departments. And as you mentioned, that was something that had really raised concerns about, you know, basically, like you said, turning state employees, health department employees, into de facto drug dealers under federal law. So instead of the state-run system, they're thinking of increasing the number of private pharmacy licenses from 7 to 12, so raising it by 5, and that's one of the real significant pieces. They're also thinking of allowing home delivery of cannabis, which will serve, they hope, people in rural areas who are far away from a local pharmacy.
Right, because that was the sort of problem that the county health department model was trying to address, was the fact that maybe these private pharmacies wouldn't be open in private, or they wouldn't have an incentive to go to the small counties because there wouldn't be a market there.
Exactly, and I spoke with Senator Evan Vickers, who's going to be sponsoring a bill if this bill comes up in a special session, and he said that the health department is able to make rules for where the pharmacies are located. So they may be able to distribute the pharmacies in some way across the state. But still, there were concerns, as you mentioned, about, you know, the accessibility for rural people. And the hope is that by allowing this courier service, that you'll be able to get people the cannabis medications that they need, even if they live in far-flung areas.
Okay, and allowing it, but it would require, I guess, one of the licensees or some of the licensees to, would all 12 of the licensees who are allowed to open these pharmacies be allowed to do courier work to deliver medical marijuana?
So it appears from what I can tell that there will be a regulatory process for sort of governing the distribution system. And from what I understand, the pharmacies themselves could be allowed to deliver cannabis, or there could be like third-party couriers who would be licensed to act as sort of go-betweens from the pharmacies and from residents and patients.
Got it. So separate company altogether.
Mm-hmm. Drones. I think they're going to deploy drones, marijuana drones.
It's only a matter of time. News columnist Robert Gerke, the idea that, you know, all of this goes back to Proposition 2, which was the voter-approved medical marijuana initiative. We had changes. Now we have more changes out of necessity, it sounds like, following the advice of county district attorneys.
Yeah.
Your thoughts on just the fact that we are trying to solve a problem that that stems from maybe changes made by the legislature?
I mean, the proponents of Prop 2 warned that this was a problem when they first started floating this, and this is why other states haven't gone this route to keep public employees to prevent. The other states have seen that they want to not expose public employees to potential criminal prosecution for doing the jobs that they're required to do. And so, you know, it's the Utah way, I guess, is try to think we're smarter than everybody else and then, you know, mess it up and have to go back to the drawing board. We've seen it with the Medicaid expansion as well right now. So I think there was some elegance in the system, as you noted, that, places, parts of the state that otherwise wouldn't be served by a free market system, the patients there would still have access that they otherwise wouldn't have. And so they've got to figure out how to crack that. The way that the initiative did it is that they required, they limited the number of dispensaries based on population and limited by the number of counties. And so that means you're going to force them to spread out a little bit. They couldn't be clustered geographically in the Salt Lake Valley, for example. And so, but these dispensaries still have to survive. They're not, unless you're going to subsidize them somehow. And so, they're back to the drawing board. The delivery system is an intriguing model. I'm not exactly sure that provides necessarily the security that they were hoping to get from the county health system.
If we can ask Bethany Rogers, who reported on this, what do they say about security? What does the state think about the security of that model?
So the people who are involved in crafting the law say that there will be a secure Security will be a high priority in the delivery system, that patients will be required to place their orders over a patient portal that will authenticate their identities, and that when...
Online, you mean? Basically.
There will be a website where they can go and place their orders that will then be delivered to them. And that when the deliveries come, they'll have to be there in person. It's not like the courier will just drop it off on their doorstep and leave. So they'll be there to receive it in person. They'll have to show their patient card and they'll have to show their identification so to make sure it's them. If it's a caretaker, same thing. They'll have to show their card and ID. And then the couriers themselves will be also subject to regulation.
Special session is going to be required. The rollout of this is supposed to happen by when are we supposed to be online with our medical marijuana?
So they're looking at March 2020 as sort of the go date. And so they want to have a special session in order to correct some of the big deal things that would affect the rollout. They say there's a lot of other tweaks and changes that they can make, but some of them are time sensitive and some of them aren't. And the ones that we're talking about today are time sensitive.
And do we know either Robert or Bethany if a special session is in the works? I mean, is it going to happen and when?
Senator Evan Vickers told me yesterday that the legislative leaders have been in talks with Governor Herbert. It's looking like they're thinking of September as a potential date, but it's still uncertain.
And I guess the one caveat probably would be that what they ended up with in the HB 3001 was a negotiated agreement between various parties. So you start tinkering with that, and the balance can be thrown off. And if you start losing support for the revisions and the program that would be put in place during a special session, it could jeopardize support for the entire program.
Okay. Bethany Rogers, thanks very much for your reporting on this.
Sure.
We will keep following it, see what happens, and when that special session comes together. We're going to take a quick break right now and then turn to more stories from this past week's news. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham, reporter Bethany Rogers, and columnist Robert Gerke. This is our Friday morning news roundup, and we invite you to join us with your questions and your comments by calling 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to us. The handle is at KCPW. And Bethany Rogers, sticking with your reporting this week, a lawmaker resigned. This is a longstanding Utah lawmaker who had driven some high-profile agendas at the state legislature, Representative Ken Ivory. Why did he step down?
He stepped down to take a job at a Silicon Slopes tech company called Geomancer, and his resignation day was Monday, the same day that he started on with them. He's going to be vice president of operations, I believe.
I've got it as senior vice president of corporate strategy.
There you go.
Yeah. Okay, so there was a little bit of controversy over the resignation. It happened, basically, he took the job in the same day that he resigned, and there were some questions about money that had been secured for this company at the state legislature. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so Geomancer is currently working on a state contract, and just to give a little bit of context and background, Representative Ivory was involved in getting them that contract in a number of different ways. The contract was related to payment in lieu of taxes, which is money that the federal government gives to local governments to compensate them for the public lands that are in their jurisdiction, since the public lands are not taxable, so those counties are not receiving property taxes. The complaint that Representative Ivory and a lot of other legislators in Utah have is that they feel the federal government is shortchanging the counties, not paying the full value of those lands. So they in 2018, Representative Ivory sponsored legislation that would require the Commission on Federalism, which he chairs, to basically review that problem or dig into that problem and try to convince Congress to pay more to the counties. Following that, later that year, he decided to try to hire a private company to undertake evaluation of these public lands in Utah to try to estimate how much property taxes were due. He secured permission in November of last year, I believe, to hire a consultant, and the consultant ended up being Geomancer.
Okay, so this is looking at how much the federal government ought to be paying in property taxes, but hasn't Ken Ivory also been a proponent for quite a while of having a federal transfer of lands? I mean, this is lands under control of the Bureau of Land Management or the Forest Service or the Department of the Interior transferred to the states?
Yeah, that's something else he's been very involved in, even at a nonprofit level. He's supported it in the legislature. He's been an ardent proponent, as you said, of the transfer back to or the transfer to state control. It's been made clear to me in recent days by wilderness advocates that from their point of view, it's not returning the lands to local control because the lands have always been in the federal government's control.
How about what kind of you mentioned wilderness advocates. Some wilderness advocates out there questioned the sort of propriety of Ivory going from this firm that is getting state dollars and jumping from his role in the legislature to that role directly. What kind of concerns did they express?
Basically just that. I mean, there was one SUA, the wilderness. I'm sorry, what was
Resource the Advocates, I think.
Western
Values Project, yeah. I believe. Excuse me. Yes, they both had things to say about this arrangement. One person mentioned that it had the appearance of self-dealing and raised red flags. So I guess there was a concern about the perception that Representative Ivory had been sort of involved in this deal and now was taking, a pretty senior level job at this company. I do want to mention, though, that, while Representative Ivory got the permission to hire a contractor, to secure a contractor, and was sort of the force behind that whole entire effort, that when it came to selecting Geomancer itself, there was an RFP process, and he was not part of the selection committee that chose Geomancer as the top finisher.
But, I mean, I guess, is his salary coming from the state funds? I mean, whether or not he okay, so he wasn't part of the RFP, but is his mm-hmm. is the money that he will be receiving at Geomancer? You know what? Scratch that question. I'm gonna ask Robert.
The answer to your question probably is that we don't know. Money is fungible. It'll go into he'll be paid by the company that's getting paid the money. So can we track a state dollar through the company to Ken Ivory's pocket? That's a little bit hard to do, but in a larger sense, it doesn't really matter. what his job is going to be for this company is going around the country and trying to get other states to sign up for the same software that he got Utah to sign up for. And that's how he's going to make his money, right? And he's going to do that by using the same position that he has held at the legislature. My point is he's done this at the legislature consistently. He created this take back the lands crusade, went and got taxpayer money to support it, went around the country and got other states to support it with their taxpayer money. And that's been his MO since he came to the legislature. And he's used groups like ALEC to try to leverage that. And I suspect we'll continue to use groups like ALEC to try to the American Legislative Exchange Council to try to leverage that. And so it points to another problem. I don't want to, hijack the discussion here, but Utah's ethics laws are a total joke. The legislature gets away with just about anything. The only way to initiate a complaint is if somebody has firsthand concrete knowledge of an issue. That's the only way to initiate an investigation. And it's why we've never seen an investigation into a legislator actually, bear fruit. Ken Ivory, because he's leaving the legislature, would no longer be subject to the legislative rules. State laws on bribery and taking gifts are also pretty weak and difficult to make stick, as we saw during the John Swallow investigation and trial. And so, chances are that he's going to get off, scot-free and collect a lot of money for a program, again, that he initiated in Utah. And if voters, he will say that people are making a big deal out of this. It had bipartisan support. Absolutely, it did. It's true. But he initiated the program. That's the sort of the fundamental point, and is going to clean up on the back end.
That, the idea that it has bipartisan support, I want to bring Bethany Rogers back into this. Again, the idea is to basically have this software that determines how much money the federal government ought to be paying. Is the federal government going to then take the data that is supplied and pony up, I guess?
Can I answer that? Yeah. No, they're not. They're not. The federal government's not going to do anything as a result of this. Bethany, you can extend it.
I don't have anything to add. No,
she is a reporter. Yeah.
I mean, I guess that's the hope. That's the dream. The Geomancer has already completed a pilot valuation of property inside Washington County, and found that the PILT payment there is way less than they think it should be. It's way less than the potential property value of the public lands, according to their estimation. And so the argument is that, the state can then use that data and go and lobby for more money from the federal government.
Yeah, counties all across the West and states all across the West have been advocating for more PILT funding for decades. And, it always ends up being pennies on the dollar that they end up getting because the federal government's broke. And so they give them what they think they can afford or what they think will shut up the counties and states. And that's what they're stuck with. There's also an argument to be made, however, that the property tax assessment should not be – you shouldn't assess a acre of barren land in Washington County the same way you would assess property in Salt Lake City, for example. And so there are questions about methodology that arises through this as well. But, and that's part of the reason to do the study. And the study may be worthwhile. Maybe we'll find out how much the state's missing out on or counties are missing out on as a result of the inadequate PILT payments.
Is the idea there to create momentum toward the land transfer project that Ken Ivory has long held?
Well, there is some indication that that might be part of it, because in the presentation that Geomancer made to the legislature, they talked about if we developed 10,000 acres of land in Washington County, here's how much the value of that land, or here's how much the value would increase. And so they're talking about developing federal land, which, is a controversial and contentious issue in itself.
Bethany, you also reported that in addition to this new contract with Geomancer, Representative Ivory has a teaching position that he has lined up. What is that?
Yeah, he does. He is teaching constitutional studies at Utah Valley University. It looks like he's teaching a 3-credit course there, and he's serving as an adjunct professor there for the fall semester at least, and we'll see if he continues doing that.
And just to wrap this up, are we going to see Ken Ivory up at the legislature, you know, not as a lawmaker, but now as a lobbyist working for Geomancer to try and either secure more funding or, you know, make their software purchasable by the state? I don't know the exact word for it.
It wouldn't be a surprise. I mean, Geomancer is working with the state now on this valuation, and the contract is for 5 years. So the relationship between Geomancer and the state is set to continue for some time.
That's already established. Gerke?
Yeah, and the revolving door rules on lobbying the legislature wouldn't necessarily apply to this because he wouldn't be a contract lobbyist. He would just be working for a company. So, yes, he would be able to do that. Whether he does it, I guess, remains to be seen.
Okay. Again, Bethany Rogers reporting for the Salt Lake Tribune on Ken Ivory and his stepping down from the state legislature to take this job. A reminder to listeners that you can call 801-355-TALK to join this conversation, or you can tweet to us. We are at KCPW. Bethany, more from you from this past week and a story that you wrote about Planned Parenthood that, you know, at the federal level, they're leaving the reproductive health program Title 10, and they are doing that after a new rule from the Department of Health and Human Services, which restricts Title 10 funding recipients from doing certain things. And maybe you can fill us in on what the new rule does, and then we'll turn to the Utah part of this.
Yeah, so the big chunk of that new rule that is raising objection is that it would prohibit Title 10 funding recipients from giving referrals to abortion referrals or telling people where they could obtain an abortion. And that's something that Planned Parenthood has called basically a gag rule, that it's something that would basically prevent them from providing the full range of services to the women who come into their clinics. And so, as you noted, rather than comply with the new rule, they decided to just forego the Title 10 funds and withdraw from the program entirely.
How much money does that represent for, you know, Planned Parenthood at the national level, but also for the state of Utah?
Oh, for Planned Parenthood at the national level, I believe it's $60 million. At the local level, it's $2 million, and it represents 40% of their annual operating revenue.
How did Planned Parenthood in Utah react to this? This is the brunt of your story.
Yeah, so they're really hoping that they said that they will not be closing any clinics or discontinuing any services. Their clients will not see any changes for the time being. It does put them in a bit of a bind. As I said, it's nearly half of their budget each year. So they're going to have to make up that funding somewhere. Some of the ideas that have been floated involve maybe charging a fee at some point down the road for patients. It could involve tapping into their donor network more heavily, also working a little bit more vigorously with some of their clients who do have insurance coverage to make sure that they're seeking reimbursement to the maximum extent possible. So those are some of the ways they're going to try to sort of absorb this loss of funding. But they said, you know, their goal is to maintain the level of service that they currently have.
You may have just said this, and it may have gone right over my head, but the percentage that $2 million represents of their budget?
40%. Yeah.
Okay. You sought comment from an organizer of a campaign against abortion here in Utah, Gail Ruzicka, who's you know, historically with the Utah Eagle Forum as well. What did she have to say?
She's very supportive of the rule change. One of the big issues here specifically for Utah is that Planned Parenthood in this state is the only recipient of Title 10 funds. There is no other organization that receives those funds here. And so there's a lot of concern that, you know, we're not getting the benefit here in Utah of that federal family planning or reproductive health program any longer. But she believes that other organizations will rise up and, if they want to, could apply for those funds and receive them. She believes that, you know, it's better that that tax dollars don't go to an organization that has any sort of involvement whatsoever with abortion. So from her perspective, this is a welcome change.
Mm. And I wonder if there will be organizations that spring up to take advantage of that lost funding.
And Bethany, just correct me if I'm wrong, but I think if the Title X money can't be used to actually pay for abortions.
That's true.
Planned Parenthood has a sort of a wall between the side that actually performs the procedure and the parts that do the family planning and so forth that Title X funds support. So it's not like these. It's not like taxpayers were paying for Planned Parenthood to perform these abortions. It's an ancillary thing that they fund completely separately.
Right, and the rule is specific to referrals, right? I mean, like now Planned Parenthood wants to be able to refer people to abortion services, but if they do that, they can't take Title X funding.
Exactly.
Okay. Once again, Bethany Rogers with the Salt Lake Tribune, bringing us up to speed on a story from this past week's news. We are going to take another break in the show and come back in just a minute. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, both on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in just a minute.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines, the weekly Friday news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Matt Canham, Bethany Rogers, and Robert Gerke. And we invite you to join us with your questions and comments. The number to call, 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to us at KCPW. Matt Canham, Senior Managing Editor. Let's get an update on a story that we covered just last week. That story was about stock prices dropping precipitously for a Utah-based company, Overstock.com, after their CEO, Patrick Byrne, publicly made some pretty remarkable claims, and some of our listeners may have heard this last week, but can you just remind us what those claims were?
Yes. Patrick Byrne said he had a relationship with Maria Butina, who is a Russian agent in prison for representing her country without following our laws. Many believe that she is a spy here. They met. They had a relationship. He says he called the FBI because she was concerned by some of the questions she was asking. And the FBI, according to him, encouraged him to continue this relationship and feed information. And now he says he was part of the deep state's investigation into Clinton's and Russia. And he called the FBI the Men in Black. He released all of this information seemingly out of nowhere on company stationery in a news release. It was one of the most remarkable things I've seen a CEO do ever.
Okay. And as a result, as I said at the, in the sort of introduction there, the stock prices for Overstock.com dropped pretty significantly. There's also a
38%.
38%. There's also a deal in the works to try and sell the company or for a purchaser to come in.
That was what was rumored. But essentially, whether that's part of this or not, it's not clear because Patrick Byrne is not going to be part of that sale. This week, in a letter to shareholders, once again on company stationery, he puts out another amazing statement announcing his resignation as the CEO and from the board. He is severing all ties.
What does he say in this remark?
He says that patriotic Americans are supporting him, but he realizes that he is a massive distraction for his company. That he thought for the good of the company, he needed to leave. He said, if the hors d'oeuvres that were served recently caused the market such indigestion, it is not going to be in shareholder interest for me to be around if and when any main course is served, which I have no idea what that is referring to, but it's amazing.
It is amazing, hinting at, you know, other bombshells to drop, I guess, in this story that he's reporting or sort of self-reporting. Is there any, again, I asked this question last week, actually, but is there evidence that the story that he's telling about being, you know, an FBI sort of informant and the relationship that he had with this alleged Russian spy and so on, is that there? Is the evidence there?
There is a little evidence. There's not a ton. Obviously, the FBI doesn't go around and say, yes, we totally told that guy to have a relationship with her as part of our investigation. They're not going to say that. But Butina's attorney did say that she had a relationship with Byrne. So that part at least has some sort of corroboration. If he acted as a source for federal law enforcement, is not something that we have from anyone but him.
Okay. Well, I want to get to the future of Overstock.com in just a second, but Robert Gerke, just you weren't here for this on last week's show. What are your comments and thoughts on on this sort of interesting statements.
It's nuts. It's great. It's really entertaining.
You could leave it at that.
I don't know if there's that much to add to it. I mean, I don't have any insight into whether he's telling the truth or not. Patrick Byrne has a track record of being a little bit of a loose cannon, or a lot of a loose cannon, I guess. In a way, if anybody was going to come out and say this sort of things on company stationery, it was probably going to be him. He doesn't show up, it appears, in the Mueller report or anything like that. But, we've got – it's a fascinating tale. It's going to be gripping to watch unfold.
Yeah, depending upon what's true, the Department of Justice might be wondering whether – this was a good federal informant to have on board.
Yes.
Okay, so what's happening, though, with Overstock? Because he's resigning, there is a kind of big name or well-known name here in the state of Utah taking over.
Well, they had an immediate bounce in their stock. It went up 8% on word that their CEO was leaving and being replaced by Jonathan Johnson, who's a longtime company executive who ran for governor in 2016 with significant financial support from Patrick Byrne. Jonathan Johnson is looked at as a more stable business leader, reliable. This is a company that sells discount goods online, and obviously it's a pretty competitive marketplace. They're also a company that has dipped into cryptocurrency far more rapidly than many other companies in this space. So we'll see if Jonathan Johnson's leadership changes the trajectory of this company.
You know what? I think we'll leave it there and just see what happens. Wait and see what happens with this story in the coming however many days and weeks. I want to squeeze one more story in before we turn to our final segment, the Underplayed Stories of the Week. And it's one that, Bethany Rogers, you covered again this week. Tax reform has been something that has been discussed quite a bit this week. There was a meeting held this week on tax reform. State leaders have been sort of going around holding town halls about whether or not tax reform is going to happen. In a podcast that the Salt Lake Tribune runs, House Majority Leader Francis Gibson made some comments that maybe caught some people off guard about the role that tax reform is going to play in the future of the state. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it was just an interesting remark. So the tax reform effort, there's actually a website set up for it, and materials that have been shared at all of the town hall meetings sort of educate people on what it's all about. And the theme, the tagline is Stronger Futures. And they've really been trying to send this message that it's time for Utah to sort of strengthen its future and set itself on the right trajectory when it comes to the budget. And keep up with a growing state. So what was interesting is that that Representative Gibson told us that at this point, he kind of doubts that whatever solution the task force will come up with in the near term will be sort of the capital S solution. He said that he doesn't see it as being a 20-year fix and kind of compared it to ongoing discussions about health reform that have stretched across many years. So he predicted that these discussions around tax reform could stretch onwards indefinitely.
And is that a sign that, I don't know, behind the scenes, because we can talk about behind the scenes in a minute with Robert Gierke, but behind the scenes discussions are hitting some hiccups or are faltering a little bit, or that there's more conflict between lawmakers than I guess, what does that portend? Maybe this is a question for Robert Gierke or for Bethany, but Robert, do you want to weigh in on that?
Oh, I think Representative Gibson is spot on. They're not going to be able to do the systemic overhaul of the tax structure that they had hoped to do when they started down this road. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a piecemeal process. It's something that has been needed to be done, they've needed to do for years, but they've kind of avoided it because it's difficult. And now we're seeing how difficult it is. I've written several times that the likeliest outcome is some tinkering around the edges, because they tried to do some taxes on services and ran into this buzzsaw with opposition from very well-connected and well-funded political interests, doctors, lawyers, that sort of thing. Now they're looking at changing the income tax structure to take money so they can use money that otherwise would go to education for other things. That's going to run into a buzzsaw from the education community.
Is that earmark really on the table? I mean, like getting rid of the earmark?
That earmark is really on the table. I mean, Senator Bramble has a bill that would strip out that earmark, amend the Constitution to strip out that earmark. And it's going to be a big fight. And so when they take this on, and they take it on in the way that they are taking it on in an election, you know, heading into an election year, I think the likeliest outcome is that they do not much of anything of substance. And as Representative Gibson says, it's going to be a multi-year ongoing process to try to refine this.
And Bethany, this is something that is planned as a discussion for the next legislative session, not for a special session, right?
Special session is still on the table, from what I understand. But if they don't get it done, that they continually are saying that it's not about doing it fast, it's about doing it right. So I think that the priority is figuring out a plan. And if it doesn't happen in special session, the likelihood is they'll take it up in the general session.
I actually spoke with Senator Bramble earlier this week and had a show on a totally unrelated topic, but he did mention the idea of that earmark and trying to do a constitutional amendment. Of course, that would have to be passed by voters.
Mm-hmm.
Would that happen? And his argument was that, you know, education hasn't been being funded the way that it's currently set up. Is there any reason to think that it would be better funded, though, if that earmark was taken away and it became one pool of money?
No, I mean, that's the flaw in the logic that they, you know, if they wanted to spend more money on education, they don't need to do anything with the education earmark. The only reason they need to get rid of the education earmark is to spend less money and take income taxes out of education. Now, Bramble's point is accurate in that they are taking money out of education anyway when they give income tax rebates and things like that or incentives to companies that come out of the income tax. And so there is some logic that, yes, when they tinker with the income tax rate or those income tax incentives sort of things, that money does come out of the education fund. But by and large, the income tax money that is collected by the state goes to education. And here's the problem. I mean, the education fund grew by 9% in the past year, a little over 9%. The sales tax revenue grew by about 3.5%. So you have one that's growing very rapidly that they would like to get their hands on, and you have one that's not growing rapidly that necessitates the need for them to go out and looking for more money. Again, I just don't see any chance that they're going to pass a tax increase, really, in a significant tax increase in an election year. And there's just too many well-connected, strong political interests that would be working against major tax reform.
Okay, and that points again to that tinkering around the edges that you mentioned before. Bethany, any part of this that we're missing before we head to our underplayed stories of the week?
I don't think so. Stay tuned. The next meeting for the task force is early September, September 5th, I believe. So okay. There's more opportunity to weigh in.
Okay, public feedback, welcome. At this exact moment, though, we're going to head to our final segment of the show, and that is Underplayed Stories of the Week. And Bethany, maybe I'll start with you.
Yes, so I just wanted to call attention to a story that my colleague Taylor Stevens wrote about Mark Smith, who was the longest-serving sexton at the Salt Lake City Cemetery. He recently passed away, but she wrote a lovely profile sort of about him and his love for the cemetery and some of the history there.
Yeah, he wrote the book on the history of the city cemetery.
Yes, he literally wrote the book.
It was a great profile. I got to say that was my first job was as a grounds guy at the city cemetery. Robert Gerke, your pick for Underplayed Story of the Week.
Not necessarily an underplayed story because it was pretty well played, but it is being well played. Courtney Tanner reported today about a detective at the University of Utah Police Department, the detective who was on the Lauren McCluskey case, who was fired because she, after having been reprimanded for mishandling the McCluskey matter, recently mishandled another matter. A young woman came to them and said she was intimidated, threatened. Her boyfriend at the time threatened to kill her. Had a voicemail from the boyfriend threatening to kill her, and the detective took vacation and didn't do anything about it. Fortunately, the young woman wasn't murdered, but the detective was fired for, again, mishandling this. And it goes back to the overall arching issue at the university. You know, they've really promoted, and I wrote about it this week, they've really promoted safety as a culture. the culture that needed to change is that the police department, they fired this detective. They've got a new police chief coming in, and they're bringing in another public safety officer. But you really have to question whether it's been effective or not.
Okay. Robert Gerke's pick, a story by Courtney Tanner, and you can check that out at sltrip.com. Matt Canham, your pick for Underplayed Story.
I'm going with one from Benjamin Wood from the legislature. It was about the AG's office, the Department of Public Safety, and the University of Utah teaming up with a company in Utah called Banjo to create what they called a lifetime intelligence platform. This would call all of social media, traffic cameras, and other sources of data that they did not explain to respond faster. And it could be responding faster to crimes. It could be responding faster to accidents. It could be responding faster to whatever they wanted. They were giving a report. And Francis Gibson, the House Majority Leader, rather unexpectedly expressed his concerns, calling this NSA Utah. He called it North Korean-esque, Orwellian. They were worried about Big Brother using this to track individual Utahns in normal courses of their daily life, and threw a huge monkey wrench into what they're going to do with this program. We've already spent $3.7 million, but if the legislature doesn't give more money, it's going to die. And so we'll see that as an issue going forward.
All right. Well, Francis Gibson making some waves with a couple of comments this week. Great pick from Matt Canham for Underplayed Story. I'm going to forego my Underplayed Story just in the interest of time. But you can find all of the stories we've been discussing today at sltrib.com. Matt Canham, Bethany Rogers, and Robert Gerke, all with Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.
This is a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard on Utah Public Radio. That wraps up this edition of Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough. Please join us again next week.